And one of the fastest ways to kill your company is get too much money too fast up front. And when people do these early seed rounds of $10 million and, you know, they do a Series A and they got $40, $50, $100 million. And it sounds so good to many inventors, innovators, entrepreneurs. Yet very quickly, the money becomes a trap.
And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast, with your host, Christine Winodo.
Our guest today is neurosurgeon, inventor, and entrepreneur, Dr. John Adler. He is a professor of neurosurgery at Stanford and perhaps best known as co-inventor of the CyberKnife, a radiation therapy device for brain tumor surgery. The CyberKnife is incredibly advanced technology. It is a small linear accelerator mounted on a robotic arm combined with an imaging system to focus the beam on the target even if the patient moves during surgery. In this episode, you'll get career advice from Dr. Adler. You might be surprised at his perspective and great insight into how startup founders should handle money and investors. It's all about the relationship. Also, growing a startup, it turns out, has a lot in common with growing a family. I hope you enjoy our conversation. If you like what you hear today, please subscribe to our series on the podcast platform of your choice. Well, thank you for joining me today. It's a really interesting time or bizarre time right now. I'm at my home, you're at your home as well during this whole COVID shelter in place. But I'd like to thank you for taking the time to talk to me for this podcast. And, you know, when I first thought about having you for our podcast guest, I want to talk a lot about your experience, which is something that we still want to talk about. But I think what we can learn a lot from this discussion is that many of our startups are facing quite a lot of challenges right now. So I know you have gone through a lot of the ups and downs being entrepreneurs, and we'll hopefully touch upon on that. And before we start, maybe we can talk a little bit about your background, why you chose to become a neurosurgeon, and where does that come from?
Thank you, Christine. I'm not sure from my background, we would have learned very much about where I ended up in life.
That's the beauty of it.
That's life, isn't it? It only makes sense looking backwards. But I grew up in a very small town in Connecticut, in kind of the blighted industrial section. Well, not far from it, even though my town itself was just a couple thousand people. My father was a bookkeeper, and I had no exposure to medicine growing up other than the town doctor, and went to kind of mediocre schools. But late in high school, found my way to a private school, and that kind of opened my horizons, and eventually private school led to a big fancy education at Harvard, and my life changed after that. But I had no inclination that I would be a physician up front or that I would necessarily be a neurosurgeon.
You think the fact that you went to private school expose you to different things that you never knew, and therefore encourage you to pursue other things that you would not have thought about?
Yeah, it opened up a world that I knew literally nothing about. And, you know, it's, if you come from a largely rural middle-class community, you just don't, you know, really the most important guy in the town when I grew up was the general practice doctor. And so that was in my brain, but I hardly knew the guy other than the fact he'd give me a few vaccinations or something. But I knew he was held in great esteem. And of course, I liked science in school. And so it's not inconceivable that I became what I, you know, became a neurosurgeon, became a doctor, but it was hardly preordained based on where I started. Ironically, my brother and the second brother went on to become a doctor as well. So I give my mother all the credit.
So when did you think about, oh, this is the path that I want to take to be a doctor?
I kind of figured it out when I went to college. And in, I went to college assuming I'd be kind of a scientist, a molecular biologist, because that seemed very cool. And that was my earliest ambition. But as I got exposed to more and more people, medicine became a career path. And, I was not unconscious of the fact that I needed to figure out how to make money in life. I didn't come from a wealthy family. And so college wasn't just for intellectual pursuits. It was to figure out how to make a living. And medicine was a logical way.
Mm-hmm. And is that because I think you decided to become a doctor, and I know you spend some time overseas as well. Is this more like, oh, I just want to try out about living in a different country, or is it more like you're pursuing something bigger?
Well, no, my life I stumbled through blindly, and it only in hindsight that, again, does it make sense. So, no, I traveled very little in life when I was young. I mean, I had never been on an airplane until I was 20 years old. The furthest I had been from my home was, Philadelphia. And I grew up in Connecticut, so I wasn't very far. When I became a physician, eventually became a neurosurgeon, again, there opened up an opportunity, really, where I had to do research for a year, and didn't know what I wanted to do. And it just so happened that there was a Swede who had worked in a lab with me, who was kind and nice to me, and we struck up a relationship. And when he went back to the Karolinska Institute, he suggested that I might want to come when I had this year off. And that's what I chose to do. Sweden seemed like a good place to spend a year. That's all.
I like how you make your decision.
Well, since I think your podcast has a lot of younger people earlier in their career, I guess my advice, which I give to a lot of young people, is to not overthink your decisions. There is no conscious decision I've made in my life that has guided me to where I am today. And I wouldn't in my wildest imagination, I think, have imagined 30, 40 years ago that I'd be doing what I'm doing today. As I look backwards, it seems inevitable. So explain that.
Yeah. So, how long were you in Sweden, and what did you do there?
Well, my second to last year of residency, I spent in Sweden for 1 year. In fact, my daughter was born there, and I went there thinking that I would pursue clinical experience in cerebral vascular surgery, which at the time interested me a lot. But I had been there only a few weeks when I discovered Professor Lars Lexell and his creation, the Gamma Knife, which was the first form of radiosurgery. And when that happened, my life was transformed.
And then when you go back to Stanford, that's when you end up starting a company based on that technology?
Exactly. So I was at the time at Harvard, when all my education was at Harvard. And when I got done with Harvard, I had made some politically stupid decisions, which destroyed any chance that I would have a job at Harvard. That's a story unto itself. But I had to get out of, as we had to say, I had to get out of Dodge and find myself a job. And as luck would have it, there was a job at Stanford, and I didn't entirely appreciate how good this job would be in my career and in my life. In fact, I was not enamored by the job in some ways because it was primarily based at the VA hospital, and I was not going to have the clinical experience that I was hoping to have. However, that too proved out to be one of the most fortunate things in my life. I was not so busy clinically that I couldn't invent.
I always found that option B sometimes is a good thing.
Don't try to prejudge the path that you're on in life. Just embrace it.
Right. Yeah. And so you're a physician, the idea of starting a company, I know some, you know, many do start a company and many don't, but you know, what make you feel like this is something that I want to do? So different from what you've been doing, you were doing before. Why jumped into it?
Because I really had no choice. I love being an operating neurosurgeon. I love taking care of patients. And truthfully, a big part of me feels incomplete these days, since I'm no longer an operating or really a treating physician. So there was really great reluctance. I started a company. I couldn't find another entity that would do the work that needed to be done. Bigger companies like General Electric and Philips, they didn't appreciate what I was doing. No NIH grant was willing to give me the money I need to do in a place like Stanford. So I couldn't do it at Stanford. I couldn't do it with a big company. The only other option was to start a company. And I basically had to look in a mirror and say, if not me, who? But truthfully, I wasn't scared about that. I didn't even know what I was getting myself into. I was clearly much more excited than scared. If I had any brains, I would have been scared. But when I was young and dumb, I just charged off and did it.
Tell me about the experience about starting the company. I know there's, do you find a CEO to run the company? I know that later on you stepped in as a CEO, but what was the thinking process? Were you doing it with somebody else?
Well, I was very young, for a medical device company. I was 35 years old, and I, could have understood up front that my best expertise or greatest contribution to the company would be my medical knowledge and my technical background. Although I'm not an engineer, I had a fairly good handle on what the technology would be required to make my earliest CyberKnife. And so those were my greatest capabilities. And soon I realized that even though I surrounded myself with a group of much more senior, experienced businessmen and engineers, that none of them could raise any money. And all the fundraising then became my responsibility. Not that I was expert in it, but I wasn't afraid to do it. I had learned from age 10 or 11 that, every job I've ever done, I always had to go off and hustle and sell people stuff. And this was no different than I was doing when I was selling newspapers when I was an 11-year-old boy. And so I ended up really doing a lot of the heavy lifting, getting the company going, but brought in a CEO who on paper had both the experience and knowledge to run an early stage company. And I was in the background, chief medical officer.
And then later on, when the company faced some challenges, I guess you stepped up and become the CEO. At some point, I think the company, it ran out of money. And I mean, I felt like this is an opportunity for company nowadays to learn from you. Like, there's many of the company right now are faced with financial challenges in the next few months or so or a year. And what do you have any advice for all these startups?
Well, number one, stay alive. I think I have a lot of advice in this domain. Stay alive. Once you're dead, you can't be born, reborn. So we didn't just run out of money once or twice. We ran out of money dozens of times. And we somehow struggled to stay alive. And understand, I wasn't formally managing the company as CEO through this situation, yet it turned out basically the fundraising and the most difficult times always fell on my shoulders. So I was never hung up on titles. And, even though in many ways, I was functioning like CEO and driving a lot of the major strategic decision making. Stanford said, you know, you can't be a faculty member and be CEO. And it worked out. I was still a busy surgeon and taking care. I was actually a very busy surgeon, taking care of lots of patients. But somehow I managed to juggle the two balls of fundraising, keeping the company going, driving some of the clinical research, and still being a very, very busy surgeon at the time. What I learned, number one, is stay alive. Number two, what I also realized in the more senior role in life is that companies are not nearly careful enough. Early stage companies are not nearly careful enough with their money in many circumstances. And one of the fastest ways to kill your company is get too much money too fast up front. And when people do these early seed rounds of $10 million and, you know, they do a Series A and they got $40, $50, $100 million. And it sounds so good to many inventors, innovators, entrepreneurs. Yet very quickly, the money becomes a trap. With that $100 million comes lots of expectations. And an idea, a company, takes a certain amount of time to germinate. It's a little like a pregnancy, you know. No matter how much you want to will it, no matter how much money you want to spend, a pregnancy is going to take 9 months. And there's a certain natural rhythm to companies. And when there's too much money interjected, there's a pressure to go too far, too fast, and then people get greedy and things blow up. The best startups find a way to really advance the ball down the field on the least amount of money. The least amount of money. And so be careful how you take money. It's yes, it's the fuel for growth, but also it's the fuel can be the seeds of self-destruction as well.
How do you balance though? Like, you know, what's the right amount of money? Because I think sometimes you do want to do things fast, like, but at the same time, you're saying just like pregnancy, you cannot fast forward certain things because it has to go through the whole 9 months. And how do you know what is the right amount of money to get for?
Well, I think this is where a mentor can be helpful. I mean, when you're young, you just want to go fast. And when you get older, you kind of come to appreciate that there's some things that just can't be sped up. And I hate to say the venture capital community has all the wrong instincts. They're locked into these 5, 6, 7 year cycles, and almost no company can deliver on these 5, 6, 7 year cycles. And they create the old seeds of their own destruction. Yet I understand why, you know, limited partners don't want to hang around for 15 or 20 years. So there is a primary disconnect with what I think how venture capital works and how companies need to work. So I'm actually a critic of venture capital as a source of income. And I think maybe increasingly family offices, which can think generational, are today may have a better inside track on funding life science startups. Now, having said this, I think it's hard to ever turn down money. My current startup, Curious, has been the best funded company of my career. Because a lot of it was self-funded and I could always take the money at a pace that was necessary and useful without incurring undue risk and not pushing things faster than they could be pushed. So I would say the ideal circumstance is to have an investor who can advance the company through that very patiently. Through its earliest stages, being very careful with money, but having lots of trust that the founder knows that the investor will be there when, if needed, but never takes that investor for granted.
This podcast is sponsored by Ron Ratnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that helps life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownratnick.com. you mentioned about trust, the importance of having that trust, and how do you build that trust between you and the investor that at least align in your mission?
Well, it's a constant struggle. I mean, there's nothing engenders more distrust than money in life, sadly. I mean, even most marriages, they blow up because of money. Just continue to be truthful and honest, and, you know, meeting expectations that you set to the greatest extent possible. The flip side is acknowledging when you don't make expectations, and startups, I think, disproportionately don't make start expectations. It's okay. I mean, they just don't. I mean, you have to have bigger ambitions than you're going to accomplish if you were any kind of entrepreneur. The ability to generate consistent and steady progress, even if it never meets forecast, to me is the telling sign of a good entrepreneur. And I, as an investor, will then turn around and have that much more confidence in such an entrepreneur.
Yeah. And I think also during the challenging and stressful time, communication is even more important. It's just like any relationship.
It's just like a marriage. I cannot emphasize enough how much a investor-entrepreneur relationship is like a marriage. And I cannot emphasize enough that companies are like children. If you want to understand what it's like to have a startup, have a child, or vice versa.
That seems, you know, I hope that's, you don't have a job so that you can learn how to start a company. But I can totally see.
They're so similar in the emotional attachment that you will generate. I mean, I have given, in all my companies, I've given the same amount of time to build a company to maturity that I gave to one of my children. Probably very similar, very similar. How many tens of thousands of hours did you invest? How many sleepless nights did you have? How much, you know, college funds, investments did you make? And how much you care, you know? And I mean, I never want to be in a situation where I say, you know, do I love my son more or my company more? You know, then sure. In the end, I think about it, but I do the right thing. But it is, they bring out the most passionate parts of ourselves, whether they be children or companies, and I cannot overstate that enough. And I do think the vast majority of entrepreneurs don't appreciate this, and they get off and they like start a company like it's a one-night stand, like they might have a child with a one-night stand and think that there's no emotional commitment here. No, it's not that way. And so I reckon don't even start a company unless you're willing to make that step. Because why waste months or years of your time when you're not really willing to be as devoted as you need to be?
Yeah, and I totally get it. And I think I use this example a lot to a lot of the startups that we work with. I always say that, you know, when you just started, you're cute, you're a baby. And then as, you know, build that relationship when you're still cute and everybody's invested in you. And when you need something, you're a teenager, you're all full of pimple. You're not that cute anymore.
Very good. So you get, exactly.
So, you know, but then if they already invested in you, they want you to be successful. Just like, you know, if you have a nephew or a niece, even though they're full of pimple, you love them, you want them to be successful, and you try to make things work for them. So I like what your analogy is about.
You get old and bald, and and all people care about is your bankroll.
I hope that's not what people care about.
I make a jest. I mean, the beauty of medical devices is that we will never necessarily have the beautiful, beautiful business models of some software company that has everything of 99% margins and minimal cost to get into a market, et cetera. But I mean, you save lives, and there's a lot of people who have spent their life making a lot of money, but they've never had the thrill of being involved in saving lives. And for them, they're almost grateful to be able to invest in a life science company, providing they believe in the mission of the company and the management team.
Yeah, I think that is very true. I felt that when you're in the space, once you have that experience, how much impact you make, then you're addicted to it. You want to keep going back to it. I know recently that you have another company, Zapp Surgical. Can you tell us more about that company?
Well, Zapp Surgical was created to address the failures in my first radiosurgical startup. I felt that the technology I developed at Accuray, my first company, was revolutionary, and I was dismayed that it was not more broadly adapted, more broadly adopted. Mm-hmm. And I felt that the world, I've come to appreciate in the world, the best medical technology is not that which wins out. And there are some realities about healthcare, about medical devices, that have nothing to do with technology, and truthfully, have very little to do with saving patients' lives. It's unfortunately about money and regulation and culture. And my earliest startup delivered brilliant clinical results, but was not conducive enough for the culture and the economic realities of healthcare. And what I've tried to do with this next startup is to make something that is both brilliant, hopefully technologically in terms of clinical outcomes, but perhaps even more importantly, addresses the financial and cultural realities of the world of medicine.
And so tell us more about the technology that you're developing at Zapp Surgical that you think that overcome what you're saying?
Well, my first generation product, the CyberKnife, delivers near miraculous outcomes in terms you can replace an open operation, which was out of all kinds of complexity and morbidity and expense with a painless outpatient procedure. I mean, isn't that a revolution? Well, it turns out that it isn't. And it's a counter-revolution for open surgeons who no longer are able to ply their trade and make more money. It's also a problem in that the money flow goes to hospitals, doesn't go to doctors. It also, the technology is in the hands of almost exclusively radiation oncologists because for regulatory reasons, they have first rights on kind of controlling radiation equipment. And so to realizing that neurosurgeons disproportionately have access to the patients, we tried to make a technology that was more conducive for neurosurgical to control and own, and by virtue of such, also make money. So this new technology doesn't require a radiotherapy vault that a traditional radiation machine does. And these vaults are one of the primary reasons that historical technologies are controlled by radiation oncologists. So now the new technology, the ZapX, can be put directly in the hands of neurosurgeons, neurosurgical practices in many circumstances, even be operated on them in many circumstances, always with the help of radiation oncologists, but it turns the business model upside down. So neurosurgeons no longer have to look at the practice of radiosurgery as a lost leader. They can now look at it as something that is a financial winner for their practice.
Yeah, and so, I mean, recently you completed your financing round, so congratulations. And it was exciting time that you get that completed. you mentioned earlier you know, in the past when you were with your first company, Accuray, even though you're not the CEO, but you're the person who's doing a lot of the fundraising. So you had a lot of success in raising money. And in this current climate, if, you know, some of the company startups who are, you know, who are not so lucky to raise their round before the current crisis, what advice do you have for them?
Well, it depends on what stage of the business they are. If they haven't started the company yet, or they're just in the earliest stages, you know, do as much as you can for as little money as possible. I mean, I like to say beg, borrow, and steal. I mean, the earliest stage of your company should involve, I think, those three attributes: beg, borrow, and steal. And let's say you're at a university. I mean, there's a lot of resources that you can feed off of. And especially when you're young, people give you, you know, free hours, consulting hours that they're going to charge me for. And, you know, there's equipment that people are throwing out. There's maybe computers that no one seems to care or want about. There's computing resources. There's probably cloud-based services that you have access to that other people wouldn't. And you can, I think in many ways, you can create, cobble together pretty good prototypes in that kind of setting that validate a lot of the primary principles. And find a way to even get all the way to clinical treatments. I mean, it may not prove the entire economic viability, but it can prove the clinical viability. Moreover, you then have access to government funding, grant funding, and for example, the National Cancer Institute has all these small business investment grants they make, and those are great sources of free funding. They too can get a company really far if you're really careful with your money. Now, under all these circumstances, you know, your executive staff is going to have to live off burritos and Snicker bars. But if you're young and you're healthy and you can, you know, you're a patient, you can literally survive for a year or two on next to nothing. And at that point, if you have some validated ideas, you can start finding your earliest angel investors. But if you're already at the stage where you need real money or some money, then I'm a big believer that angels, investors, and family offices are good places to go. And I think, you know, when you've made $1 billion as some private equity firm, you can't spend it. I mean, at some point, it's a trap. You know, and by the way, I don't have that kind of money, so I'm speaking from extrapolation, that at some point, you got to do something with your money. I have one thing I'm confident of, you can't take it with you to your next life. So somehow, some way, you got to figure out, and you can't even give that much to your kids even. So you're looking almost invariably to how to do good work with your money. And a lot of people with billions of dollars have made it in an entrepreneurial world, and they appreciate what entrepreneurs do in this life. And I think innately, they're looking for entrepreneurs to believe in. And my dream is in 5 or 10 years that I'm in that position. So I think ex-entrepreneurs do try to support each other. And they make excellent angel investors, especially if they're successful enough to have $1 billion or something and have their own family office. So when fundraising, start with beg, borrow, steal, get to a certain threshold, then feed off small government grants where possible, like SBR grants. Then maybe you can pick the pockets of a few, you know, family members who have, can maybe invest $10,000, $100,000. And then start thinking about things like family offices, or, you know, former entrepreneurs. And even at that point, then you might want to think about industrial partners or God forbid, venture capitalists. But once you get in bed with the venture capitalists, they will drive your business. They have a time frame. They have a certain series of, and they can be smart people, but they have a gun to their head to deliver something in 5, 6, 7 years. And there's just not many businesses that fit that profile, especially in healthcare.
Right. And I think I always tell people that everybody has different stakeholders that they have to answer to. So it's not that, you know, it's that's the reality that venture capital has.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, thank you for that advice. And I think that is a sound, you know, good advice. I think I like, you know, this definitely the big boring steel. That's something that every entrepreneur has to go through, it, be it a good time or a bad time, actually. And I think in the, you know, difficult times, that's even more crucial, I think. So with that, you know, thank you for your time. And
thank you, Christine.
I hope we pass through this whole COVID-19 within the shelter in place, put us behind us soon rather than later. But with, you know, just like pregnancy, I guess sometimes you have to wait it out. You cannot rush it, I guess.
It's a natural phenomenon. It's going to do what it's going to do.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Christine. You stay safe yourself.
Thank you for listening today. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.